You know, you have to realize your limitations, Senator. Exactly what are you going to do? Report me to the police? You'll go right down with me. We're welded together. You go to the White House, I go with you. Get used to it. Grant moved behind her desk and gave it a kick. Parrish thought for a second that she had done it out of anger or had stumbled, but she stooped, and when she came up she had a gun in her hand. Parrish knew all about guns and recognized it, a Beretta, a big one, a military-style 92, loaded with 9mm man-killers. It'd produce internal cavitation that you could fit a football in. She was moving toward him, and he was pressing back in the couch. He heard the safety click off, and if he tried to get up, she might pull the trigger.
"Don't do that," he blurted. "I don't... What am I going to do? Who will I get to do it? Is that what you want to know?"
She was shouting again, and there was a fleck of saliva at the corner of her mouth.
"What if I get me? How'd that work?"
The muzzle was 3 feet from his nose, and he muttered,
"That'd work fine, I guess. That'd be... Don't do this."
Grant's finger was white on the trigger, and Parrish could plainly see that from 36 inches away, and he could hear her labored breathing. And then she stepped back, dropped her voice, and snarled,
"Don't ever fuck with me.
I know your background. I know you're a little crazy. Keep this in mind. I'm way, way crazier than you are." He hadn't started to sweat until she backed away, but he was sweating now. "I see that," he said. The gun was still pointed at his nose. Her finger was still white on the trigger. She looked like she wanted to pull it. He could see it in her glittering blue eyes.
"I'm okay with it. I won't make a single fucking move without talking to you about it."
"Better," Grant said. She pointed the muzzle at the ceiling. "Now, is there anything we have to do about Smalls? I mean, right now."
"Probably best to lay back in the weeds and not do anything," Parrish said, his voice trembling. He tried to smooth it out. "If we decide to take another run at him, we have time. I'll tell you what, though. He's got his Oppo people digging around through your investments back in Minnesota. If you want to be president, there better not be much back there."
"There's not. Nothing illegal. Not that he could get at, anyway." She stooped and dropped the gun in a desk drawer. Parrish noted which one it was in case he needed that information in the future. He would not be back down in this basement without a gun in his belt. Though he probably wouldn't need one. Before this confrontation, he'd thought of Grant as a Minnesota blonde, with everything that might suggest. Nice, sweet, maybe a little above average, but not too much above average, and certainly not dumb. That had changed in the last 2 minutes. 2 minutes later, when he went out the door, still alive, he realized that he had suddenly come to respect her as much as any sociopath could. "She's crazier than I am." When he was gone, Grant remained in the basement, brooding about the mistake with Smalls and the possible consequences. Would the cops figure out what had happened? Was there any way she could interfere without being tagged as responsible? Could Smalls somehow be blamed for the accident? If she got rid of Parrish permanently with a bullet, would that seal her off from any investigation? One other man knew about her arrangement with Parrish and had supplied the operators who went after Smalls. If she killed Parrish, he'd still be out there. When she'd been elected to the Senate, Taryn Grant had bought the mansion in Georgetown, which backed up to Dumbarton Park. The house was supposedly 70 years old, but if there were more than a few molecules left from the original structure, she hadn't been able to find them. Built of red brick with a terrific garden behind 8-foot brick walls, everything had been updated to the point where the house might as well have been built a year earlier.
She had an eye for good houses, and as stately as this house was, and as well located, the major attraction was that it had been previously occupied by the outgoing Secretary of Defense. The basement had been reworked at taxpayer expense to be absolutely secure and was known as a skiff space, she had learned when she got to Washington. She'd had her own security firm go over it inch by inch, and they'd found no faults. Sitting down in the basement, she might as well have been in a bank vault. If she'd actually shot Parrish, her biggest problem would have been cleanup and disposal, because nobody outside the place would have seen or heard anything. And, she thought, it might still come to that. Grant was rich. She was also tall, blonde, and physically fit. She controlled most of $1 billion, her share of her family's agricultural commodities business, the fifth largest privately held company in the United States, now run by an older brother. In addition, she owned two small but profitable internet companies, run by remote control through CEOs as ruthless as she was, but with less money. As a tall, blonde, physically fit woman, there were rumors about her supposedly voracious sexuality, though nobody had the photos. The fact was, she was okay with occasional sex, if performed discreetly with attractive men, but she was hardly voracious. Power, not sex, was the drug she mainlined. She wasn't much interested in policy, or the Senate, or being on television. She wanted the hammer, the biggest one she could find. Barack Obama was her hero for one reason and one reason alone. He'd served a single term in the U.S. Senate before he became president. Madam President had a nice round sound to it. If everything went just right, Grant was 2 years out. But not everything was going just right, because Parrish's goons had failed on what had seemed a straightforward mission. Kill Smalls and make it look like an accident. Parrish had stood in the skiff and laid it out like a commando mission. That's all these guys have done for most of their adult lives. The people they took out, not all of them were from enemy countries. Sometimes you need to remove a particular guy in a friendly country, she'd asked. Like Pakistan? Yeah, and like Germany. 4 days after she'd pulled the gun on Parrish, Grant had him back in the skiff. A blinking red light on her desk told her that he was armed. She opened the desk drawer where she kept the Beretta so it would be handy, but she didn't take it out. She was angry all over again, though this time better controlled.
You know that there was some controversy around my election, that people died, she said.
It wasn't a question. Yes, I know, Parrish said. Then you know the name Lucas Davenport? I read all the clips. He was the cop who led the investigation, Parrish said. A year or so after the investigation, he was appointed to be a U.S. Marshal, Grant said. He got the job because Smalls and the former Minnesota governor, Henderson, the guy who ran for vice president. Yes, they pulled some strings in Washington, got him the new job, Grant said. I don't know what his position is, except that he was involved in a major shootout down in Texas last year. Anyway, guess what? Smalls has him on your accident case. He won't find anything, Parrish said. There's nothing to find. I've read the West Virginia State Police files now. I had a guy get copies off their computers, and they've officially determined that it was a one-car accident resulting in minor injuries to one person and death to the other. No alcohol involved, no charges pending. Routine. Case closed.
Happy to hear it. But I need to know what Davenport's doing, Grant said. He is intelligent, and he is dangerous. When I say dangerous, I mean a killer. You think your super spies can handle that?
Parrish didn't like the sarcasm, but he said, "Sure. I'll need some money." "We have a family office in Minneapolis," Grant said. "There's a man there named Frank Reese. I will send him a message telling him to expect you or one of your associates. He will give you whatever amount you need in cash, but I expect it to be accounted for. I'm not cheap, but I won't tolerate being chumped."
"I understand," Parrish said.
"When you say send a message, thoroughly encrypted, to a site that only Reese and I know about," Grant said.
"Good. I'm impressed," Parrish said. "Look, if this gets complicated, would it be better to ask Reese for a big chunk all at once, or better to go back to him several times?"
"How much do you need?" she asked.
"I don't know. If every time we go back, it could be tied to a particular event. That could be a problem. We may need several events over the next couple of years." She nodded.
"I'll tell Reese to give you a half," she said. "How soon can you look at Davenport?"
"Half of what?"
"Half a million," she said. "Is that going to cover it?"
Impressed again, though Parrish didn't say so. "I'll fly out to Minneapolis this afternoon. I'll want to handle Reese myself."
"Keep the loop tight," Parrish said.
"I'll have somebody on Davenport right away. Figure out where he's staying."
"He probably doesn't have a hotel yet. I've been told he won't actually get here until tomorrow or the next day."
"Where are you getting this information?" Parrish asked.
"I have a friend in the Smalls organization."
"Huh." Impressed again. "If Davenport's flying commercial, we can pick out his flight and spot him at the airport when he gets here."
"Do that." She waved him toward the door. "Stay in touch."
On the way out, Parrish paused, then turned. "You want to know everything, so I have a proposition that you might be interested in. Or you can kill it."
"What?"
"If this Davenport guy wasn't investigating the incident, who would be?" She thought about it and said,
"I don't know. Maybe nobody.
Davenport has a personal problem with me. He thinks I had something to do with the murders around my election. He wants to get me. Nobody else that I can think of has the same incentive, except maybe Smalls himself."
"Still, he's a small-town cop, right?" "Jesus, Parrish, it's not a small town," Grant said. "There are 3 million people in the Twin Cities metro area. Davenport was an agent for the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. They've got the technical abilities of the FBI.
"Still."
"Still? Bullshit. I know a lot about Davenport. He dropped out of law enforcement for a couple of years, invented a computer software company, and sold out for something between $20 and $30 million, and he's now worth maybe $40 million. He built that company and sold it in 2 years, starting with nothing. If you underestimate him, he'll eat you alive."
"All right, I get it. If we had a guy who wasn't as smart and didn't have the incentive, that would be better for us, right? What if Davenport got mugged and hurt? Not killed, but hurt bad enough to take him out of it. Take him out long enough that the Smalls accident is old news. Antique news." Grant leaned back in the office chair, pursed her lips. After a while, she said, "That has some appeal. For one thing, I'd like to see him get hurt. He does have a history as a shooter, though. It'd be dangerous."
"My guys could pull it off. Abort at the last second if something doesn't smell right. They'd rob him so it'd look just like a mugging."
She considered for another moment and said, "Let's take a look at him first. See what he's up to, whether it'll go anywhere. Then we can consider taking him down."
Parrish nodded. "I'll have somebody look at his hotel room. Tell your man in Minneapolis I'm on my way."
When Parrish had gone, Grant closed down the skiff,
found the housekeeper, told her to bring a fried egg sandwich with ketchup and onions and a glass of Chablis into the breakfast room. She had homework to do, constituency stuff, boring but necessary. She read through notes from her chief of staff and her issues team.
But when the sandwich came, she put the paper aside and ate, peering out into the backyard garden.
Three huge oaks, three smaller hard maples, a Japanese maple specimen that would turn flaming red in September, a ginkgo tree, all surrounded by a rose garden. She thought about Davenport. She'd told Parrish that she was crazy, and she had heard that Parrish was a couple of fries short of a happy meal himself. In her mind, there were all kinds of crazy, including a couple of kinds that could be useful if they didn't take you too far out. A touch of OCD helped you focus obsessively when you needed to do that. A bit of the sociopath was always helpful in business. You took care of yourself because nobody else would. Grant was all of that. A little bit of OCD, a little bit of sociopathy. And she thought Davenport was as well. He was surely a sociopath, given his record of killings, she thought. How could he live with himself if he weren't? The problem was, he was also seriously intelligent. She wasn't sure that Parrish appreciated that. Davenport had made that big wad of software cash, but instead of trying to work it, he'd gone back to hunting. He was nuts, she thought, like she was. He was coming for her. Something had to be done. 4. Lucas flew early on Monday, a blessedly short flight from Minneapolis into Washington. One of Smalls's Minnesota aides had dropped a map and a key at his house on Saturday. He was carrying two substantial bags with him, one with neatly layered summer suits and shirts, underwear, socks, and dop kit, as well as a couple of pairs of gym shorts, several heavy T-shirts for workouts, a pair of cross-training shoes, and three burner phones he had bought at a Best Buy on Sunday. The other bag, a heavy-duty Arc'teryx backpack, contained his laptop, an iPad, yellow legal pads and mechanical pencils, a compact voice recorder, a Sony RX-10 Mark III camera, and all the associated chargers, cables, batteries, and memory cards. The camera was a chunk, and he was tempted to leave it behind, but Weather had bought it for him when he joined the Marshal Service, so he felt bound to take it. Getting the rental car was a minor hassle, but an hour after he landed, Lucas headed out of Washington in a rented black Range Rover Evoque with a back window about the size of his hand. Hot day. The mountains ahead were covered with a blue haze of humidity that shimmered like a gauze curtain above the interstate. The car's navigation system took him on twisty highways through the mountains and most of the way to Smalls's cabin. The nav got lost the last 2 miles, and he went the rest of the way with the paper map. He was aware that he had driven past the place where Smalls had gone off the road, but he ignored it. He wanted to start from the cabin and experience the drive out as Smalls and Whitehead had. The cabin sat 100 feet back from the road, hidden by a screen of trees which opened to a grassy lawn that spread up a short slope to the cabin. And it was, indeed, a cabin. Bronze-colored logs with pine-green painted steps leading to a front porch. A pickup had backed up the driveway with a flat trailer behind it, and an elderly woman with tight white hair was riding a John Deere lawnmower around the yard. When Lucas got out of the Evoque, she turned the mower off, took off her earmuffs, and asked, "Y'all lost?"
"Not if this is Senator Smalls's place."
"It is,"
the old woman said.
"But he ain't here."
"I know. He's in Minneapolis," Lucas said. He showed her his marshal's badge and said, "I'm a U.S. marshal working on a case with Senator Smalls. He gave me a key."
"You investigating that wreck?"
she asked. "Yeah, checking it out.
Tell you what, Marshal, that was one fucked-up Cadillac. I went over to Bill Bunsen's yard and took a look at it.
Where's that at? Lucas asked.
Up to Green Spring, she said.
Still there?
Unless the cops hauled it away, or the senator did, she said.
Maybe I'll go up and take a look, Lucas said. Lucas went into the cabin, which was hot and stuffy, punched Smalls's code into the security system, turned on the air conditioning, peeled off his jacket, got a bottle of Fat Tire from the refrigerator and a sack of pretzels from the cupboard, and went back out and sat on the porch. The old woman had moved around behind the cabin, still mowing, and 5 minutes after Lucas got outside, she drove the mower back around to the front lawn and onto the trailer behind her pickup truck. She killed the mower's engine, pulled up the loading ramp and locked it, and said to Lucas, "Good hot day for a beer."
"There are a few more in the refrigerator. Help yourself."
"I'm not sure the senator would be okay with that."
But she didn't walk away from the offer. "I'll tell him I drank too," Lucas said. The old woman nodded and said,
"My name's Janet Walker, and I thank you kindly."
She went inside and a minute later came back out with another Fat Tire, sat down on a wicker porch chair.
"You getting anything good on the accident?"
Lucas shook his head. "Got to Washington about 3 hours ago from Minnesota. I'm waiting for a West Virginia highway patrolman to show up. He's going to tell me all about it."
"The rumor around here is the senator got drunk and drove off the side of the road and blamed it on his dead girlfriend," Walker said.
"Girlfriend? I thought she was a political aide."
"Yeah, well, I don't doubt she was aiding the senator one way or the other. Don't tell the senator I said that. I need the work."
"You're safe with me," Lucas said. "You know anything about the accident?"
"Not a fucking thing," Walker said.
She tipped her head back and took a generous swallow of beer, and when she took the bottle down, she said,
"Nothing like a nice cold beer after you mowed yourself some weeds. Don't know nothing about the accident, but I heard that the senator told the cops that they was run off the road by a pickup truck. There was a couple of strange guys going through here with a pickup that weekend. Seen them around the day before the accident, and not seen them since."
"Is that unusual?"
"Well, no, maybe not. Maybe you remember that kind of thing when something like the accident sets you off. These guys seem to be looking around, but not doing anything in particular. Saw them myself, and my boss saw them, too. The kind of guys who were in really good shape. Those black razor sunglasses and ball caps squared away military-looking."
"Huh. Anybody tell the cops?"
"Tell them what? That we saw some guys in a pickup truck?"
"What kind of truck?" Lucas asked.
"Black Ford F-250. New," she said. "Or almost new."
"Local plates?"
"Didn't notice."
Walker didn't have much else to say. She finished the beer and headed up the road in a cloud of yellow dust. Lucas went back inside the cabin and poked around for a while. There were four smallish bedrooms, the master with a king-sized bed, the other three with two beds and bathroom each. Lucas owned a cabin himself and recognized the layout. It was more or less a dormitory meant to sleep as many people as possible inside a fairly spartan envelope. The living room was separated from the compact kitchen by a breakfast bar, with a dining table and 8 chairs parallel to the bar. A poker table was sitting in a corner, and there were scratches on the plank floor where it had been pushed into the middle of the room when needed. A couch and 4 overstuffed chairs faced a 60-inch TV. He'd been looking around for 10 minutes. He'd spent 2 of those minutes with the joy of sex, which he found under the bed, when a car pulled into the driveway. He went back out on the porch as Carl Armstrong was climbing out of a state police vehicle. a blue and gold Chevy SUV. Armstrong was Lucas's age, a heavy-set man with a red face and a gray flat-top haircut, wearing tan slacks and a blue dress shirt. He raised a hand to Lucas and walked around to the passenger side, popped open the door, and came out with an old-fashioned leather briefcase.
"You Marshal Davenport?"
he asked as he came up to the porch steps.
"That's me," Lucas said. "You're Carl?"
"Yep."
"Damn, it's hot."
"I got a key from the senator. Turned the air conditioning on.
Come on in. You want a beer?"
Armstrong didn't drink on duty, so Lucas got them two Diet Pepsis. They sat at the dining table, and Armstrong produced an accordion envelope from his briefcase that contained a stack of paper, several sheaves held together with spring clips. He peeled them apart and shoved them across the table at Lucas.
"Photos of the car, reports from the lab, photos and reports from the scene, transcripts of interviews with Senator Smalls, a transcript of the 911 call. It's all yours."
"Senator Smalls said you seemed competent," Lucas said. "I'll go through the paper inch by inch, but what I want is your best judgment, off the record. What happened here?" Armstrong had an accent that Lucas could only think of as wiry, something like an early Hank Williams recording on vinyl. He said,
"I do appreciate the senator saying that. He can be scary if you're sitting on the far end of some federal funding, you know what I mean? Wouldn't want him pissed off at West Virginia 'cause of something I said."
Lucas nodded. "I was with the Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension for years before I took this job. People would get seriously puckered up around federal grant time."
"Exactly,"
Armstrong said. He put his elbows on the table and linked his fingers.
"Anyway, 19 out of 20 accident investigators would give you the same story about what happened that night. Maybe the senator's girlfriend got careless, or maybe there was another pickup that scared her and she drove off the road. Or, don't quote me on this, the senator reached over and gave her a little pluck, and over the side they went, because there's no physical evidence of anything else."
"She wasn't on her cell phone?"
"No, one of the first things we checked. The senator wasn't either."
"They both made calls earlier in the afternoon, but nothing after about 4 o'clock when the senator made a call to a woman in Washington who works as an aide."
"A Kitten Carter?"
"Yes.
Ms. Carter said it was a routine business call. I didn't ask what it concerned because that has no connection with the accident."
"So 19 out of 20 would say Senator Smalls's story about the other truck was wrong one way or another, that nothing hit them. And what would the 20th accident investigator say?" Lucas asked.
"That would be me," Armstrong said. "I have filed all these reports, and if anybody looks at them, they'll get the same conclusion as the other 19. But I'll tell you, Marshal, there's something not right about it. They went off the road, where it's perfectly straight, at the top of a hill, at a place with the biggest drop into the river. Wasn't any reason for Ms. Whitehead to jerk the steering wheel to the right, not unless she was trying to kill them both. The way she fought that truck going down the hill, it sure don't look like she was trying to kill herself. If somebody was trying to kill them, and if they tried to do it by ramming that caddy, that's the exact spot they would have picked. The road is narrow, and gravel don't give the best footing. And if the truck was overtaking them and gave them a good whack..."
"Over they'd go," Lucas suggested. Armstrong bobbed his head.
"Senator Smalls's story felt strong to me. You couldn't fake a story like that and sell it to me. I'd sniff it out if he was lying. With the senator, I had the feeling that he was telling the truth, or at least thinks he was. Why would he lie?"
"Neither one of them was drunk."
"And she was driving. No crime there. Now, he says that when they left the cabin, he sort of dozed off. He woke up when Ms. Whitehead said something about the jerk coming up behind them. Is it possible that he thought they were hit, that he believes they were hit, when what actually happened is that Ms. Whitehead got scared and yanked the wheel over? I mean, there's no physical evidence that they were hit by another truck. How do you pull that off?
Don't know off the top of my head. If they were professionals,
that's where I get off the bus, Armstrong said. I don't believe in that kind of thing, professional killers.
I understand that, Lucas said. Look, I don't know anything about accident investigation, but you'd say that it seems completely unlikely, that there are much better alternative explanations. But your gut tells you something unusual happened.
That's it, Armstrong said. My God, don't write the reports, though.
Let's go look at the scene, Lucas said. Lucas turned on the security system, locked the cabin, and on the way out to their vehicles, he told Armstrong about his chat with Janet Walker, about the men with the sunglasses and the black Ford F-250. If one turns up with some unusual dents,
I'll make a note. Armstrong said. Maybe even spend a couple of hours sniffing around.
Armstrong led him up the track that went out to the state road and down that road to the point where Whitehead and Smalls went over the side. They pulled well off to the left, and Lucas got out and looked down toward the river.
South branch of the Potomac. Real nice river, Armstrong said.
He pointed to a notch in the thin roadside berm.
That's where they went over. You can still see the busted-up brush and the tracks where Ms. Whitehead steered along the hillside until they hit the trees.
Lucas looked down the hill at the tracks. 150 feet down, the hillside suddenly steepened, not quite to a 90-degree drop, but close enough. If they'd gone over, they might have bounced once, but they would have been mostly airmailed right into the river.
Hell of a job getting over to the trees, Lucas said. Almost saved them. Should have, Armstrong said. Car rolled over. We think that's when Ms. Whitehead was killed, at the very end of the incident. They were crashing down through those trees, some of them pretty big. It looks to me like she was deliberately trying to hit them. To slow the car down, and a branch or part of a tree come through the driver's side window and hit her in the temple, poked a hole right through her skull and into her brain. The medical examiner found pieces of bark inside her skull. His report is in the file.
He went through the sequence as reported by Smalls, and he and Lucas walked down along the hillside through knee-high weeds and grass to the spot where the Cadillac rolled over. Lucas could still see black patches of dried oil on the pale grass.
According to Senator Smalls, he crawled out of the pickup, which was upside down, got a pistol out of the back because he thought the people in the truck might be coming down after them, and then dragged Ms. Whitehead out. Nobody came down the hill. If there was a truck, it kept going. Sheriff's deputies took about 11 minutes to get here from the first 911 call. The ambulance got here a minute later. First state police car got here 10 minutes after that.
Is that fast or slow? Lucas asked.
Not real quick, probably average. The deputies got a lot of territory to cover out here.
Lucas walked slowly back up the hill, along the scarred earth and brush left behind by the Escalade, and asked,
"No sign of another vehicle's tracks?"
"Not in the loose gravel," Armstrong said.
"If there were any, the responding deputies drove over them. Didn't find any broken glass, either."
"How far to the nearest highway from here?"
"Couldn't tell you precisely. Maybe a few miles, maybe a bit more, maybe a bit less. We could do a Google Earth if you want."
"I can do that," Lucas said, "if I need it." They were both sweating heavily by the time they got back to the cars, and Armstrong asked Lucas if he'd be staying overnight at the cabin. Lucas shook his head. "I've got some interviews to do in Washington. I'll give you my cell phone number in case you need to reach me."
"Wouldn't count on us coming up with anything new," Armstrong said. "With the senator involved, we pulled out all the stops on this one."
"I'd like to look at the Cadillac myself," Lucas said. "I understand it's still around."
"Yeah, the truck was pulled up the hill by the local towing service. Hell of a job, too. Took 2 trucks 4 hours. If you want to follow me, it's probably 20 minutes from here."
Lucas followed. Bunsen Towing was run out of a junkyard set in a patch of trees that butted up against a railroad right-of-way. The truck had been parked under a tin-roofed shed and wrapped in a blue plastic tarp. A man Armstrong introduced as Laurie Bunsen came out of the yard's office and helped Armstrong pull the tarp off. The truck hadn't been cleaned up, and the blood on the front seat had gone seriously bad in the heat. Flies were crawling all over it, buzzing around them after the tarp was off. Lucas didn't look, but he was sure that if he stuck his head inside, he'd find a motherload of maggots.
"Stinks," Bunsen said to Armstrong. "When you think they're going to move it?"
"You seen an insurance agent yet?"
"Not yet. Some chick called from Washington and said State Farm would be out, but I ain't seen hide in a hair nobody from State Farm," Bunsen said. "You will, I'm sure," Armstrong said. "This machine is too pricey to let it go."
"I'll talk to somebody. Get them out here," Lucas said.
"Don't make no never mind to me," Bunsen said. "I get $20 a day for storage."
They walked around the Escalade, looking at the damage, which was worse than Lucas had imagined it. The truck had probably sustained 15 or 20 separate impacts, both sides, the front and the back. Even the roof had taken a pounding. The left front wheel had folded under the truck, with the frame sitting on the side of the tire, and the driver's side window had been smashed entirely out of its frame. All the rest of the glass was cracked, including the glass in the mirrors, as well as the head and tail lights. Lucas checked the side, where there were 4 wide marks that looked like they could have been made by trees. Armstrong said, pointing them out,
"We took biological samples off here, and we matched them to the trees down the hill. The bark is right."
Lucas walked to the Evoque, got the Sony camera, and took several shots of the Cadillac's driver's side. "All right," he said after a few more minutes, brushing a fly away from his face. "I'm done here. Thank you both. Carl, you see or hear anything more or figure anything out, call me. About anything, no matter how small, any time." Lucas gave Armstrong a card with his cell phone number on it. They shook hands, and Lucas headed back to Washington. He was sure he was imagining it, but the stink of the rotting blood seemed to cling to his clothing, maybe permanently. He pushed a few buttons until he found the one for the sunroof, opened it wide, and breathed in all the great weed and flower-scented country air. 5. Lucas checked into the Watergate Hotel because Smalls owned a condo in one of the Watergate complex buildings, and Kit and Carter had an apartment in another. The hotel was okay, if a little heavy on the 60s decor in the lobby. Lucas got a small suite, jumped in the shower, brushed his teeth, put on slacks, a pink golf shirt, and a blue jacket, and called Carter. "Are you available?" he asked when she had answered the phone and he'd identified himself.
"I am,"
she said. "You want to come to me, or should I come to you?"
"I could meet you in the hotel restaurant in 20 minutes. Should be fairly quiet tonight."
Her contralto voice had a slight growl to it.
"That'll work," Lucas said. "How'll I know you?" she asked.
"I'll be the guy in the blue jacket and pink golf shirt." "Probably not too many of those.
Not with a gun under the jacket."
Lucas did have a gun under his jacket, a new one, a Walther PPQ, the same 40 S&W caliber as the Glock pistols issued to most U.S. Marshals. Lucas had one of those, too, but didn't like it and didn't carry it. He'd begun to carry the new pistol on his left hip, in a cross-draw position, which made it easier to get at and less obvious than the 45 he'd carried for most of his career. When he was checking into the hotel, he'd been eye-checked by a security man in a gray suit. Lucas nodded at him, and, after he got his keys, walked over with his badge and ID case.
"Just so you know," he said.
"I suspected, but thank you," the security guy said. "You gonna be here long?"
"I don't know," Lucas said. "I'm working."
"I'll pass the word to our other security people. Nobody will bother you."
Lucas patted his shoulder and took the elevator up.
Later, in the restaurant, Lucas got a table for two, a beer and a bowl of nuts, and had been waiting for 5 minutes when Carter showed up. She was a short, bottle blonde woman, with arched, thin black eyebrows, who looked like she might work hard to avoid anything resembling a gym. She was in her mid-30s, Lucas thought, and was wearing a jade-green dress with open-toed leather sandals. She spotted Lucas, twiddled her fingers at him, walked over, and took the chair opposite him.
"Beer guy, huh?"
She had a soft southern accent.
"Yeah, hot day."
She ordered a dirty martini with 3 olives and, when the waiter was gone, asked, "Well, do you believe Senator Smalls?"
"Yes, he has no reason to lie to me. I believe he'd be reluctant to see me investigating something he was lying about."
"Ooh," she said, "you do have a good opinion of yourself."
Lucas shrugged and said, "I get things done. That's why the senator invited me in."
"Well, the West Virginia investigator doesn't believe him," she said.
"That's not exactly correct," Lucas said. "I talked to the guy this afternoon, and he thinks something about the accident smells wrong. He doesn't have a single piece of evidence, but his gut tells him that Porter was telling the truth, that there was another truck." He went through what he'd learned from Armstrong, including the cop's personal judgment. "That won't show up in his written reports because he has no support for it."
"Okay." The martini came, and she took it, fished out 2 olives, munched on them, nodded at the waiter, and when they were alone again, she asked, "What do you need from me?"
"Tell me what you do," Lucas said.
"What the senator tells me to. I used to do a lot of research, but now I mostly manage the office, figure out what research we need, and make sure the research gets done. I read everything I can find on all sides about various policy options. I do liaison work with other senatorial aides, or House aides, or White House aides, and talk to media people. This week it's mostly been damage control."
"Is Cecily Whitehead's death going to hurt him?"
She thought about that for a minute, then said, "No. The fact that she was killed makes the story harder to control, but there's no definite proof that they were out there for sexual reasons. The medical examiner was kind enough not to look."
"Kind enough?"
"Sort of encouraged to believe it wasn't necessary."
"I see."
She shrugged. "Even if he had looked, that kind of thing happens all the time around here. Sex, adultery, I guess. Nobody wants to talk about it because too many powerful people do it. Politicians, staff, lobbyists. Even if there were proof that Porter and Cece were sexually involved, it wouldn't make the news here in Washington. I suppose it might back in Minnesota. But I doubt even there. The fact is, half the newsies are sleeping with somebody they shouldn't be sleeping with, so sex doesn't get reported. If word got out in the papers to the public, it might get a little embarrassing at Senate cocktail parties with all the senators' wives from Idaho and Utah and such, but that'd be about it."
If the senator was killed, would it derail anything? Any important legislation, anything like that? She thought again and said, "This summer it might have. If Porter had been killed and you've got a Democratic governor in Minnesota, he'd be appointing a Democrat to replace Porter. The Senate's balanced on a knife edge. If Porter were replaced by a Dem, it'd be even tighter. So, there's that. Then, if the senator was carrying a particularly important piece of pork, and somebody was desperate that it not get passed, maybe then killing him might stop something." "Give me an example," Lucas asked. She pulled the bowl of nuts closer, took a few of them, crunched them, and said, "Okay. Say Porter had a widget factory in his district, and he planned to sneak a few lines into an appropriations bill that would give that factory and no other widget factory a tax break. That would give the factory a price advantage over all the other widget factories.
The folks who own those other factories could get upset."
"Enough to kill somebody?"
"Suppose the widgets were actually electronic suites and critical to construction of the Navy's new Ford class of aircraft carriers. Say the suites sold for $70 million each, and the Navy wanted 6 for each carrier, and there'll be 2 more carriers after the Ford. Could you get somebody killed for $1 billion?
"Know the right guy, you could get somebody killed for the keys to a 5-year-old Prius," Lucas said. She grinned.
"There you are," she said.
"But you couldn't get anybody good," Lucas amended. "You couldn't get a serious pro.
But for a couple of $100,000, plus an office at the White House?"
"Okay. Was Smalls carrying a bill like that? Anything that important?" She took another scoop of nuts and said,
"It'd be an amendment, not an entire bill. But no. I'll review what we're doing this session. I can get back to you tomorrow, but there's nothing I can think of. And I'll tell you, this kind of stuff goes on all the time in Washington. Tight votes, preferential tax rates, and nobody gets killed. Not for that kind of stuff."
Smalls had a particular person in mind for this attempt, accident, whatever it was, Lucas said.
"I know."
She reached out to the bowl of nuts again, pushed it away.
"Don't let me eat any more of those things. They make me fart."
"Okay." She had made him smile.
"I've been thinking about that particular person, reading up on her," Carter said. "She hates Porter like rat poison, of course, because Porter won't keep his mouth shut about what happened in that election. If he keeps talking, he could queer her presidential ambitions. You could consider that a motive."
"Yes."
"About means, she's on the Senate Intelligence Committee, and she has an aide who does nothing but committee work for her. He worked for the CIA for 5 or 6 years before he moved over to the Hill. He was in the Army before that, and he has contacts all over the intelligence community, both public and private. He is a pit viper of the first degree, a fixer, a sneak, maybe crazy. He would know people who'd take the job. Our particular person has all the money in the world to pay for it."
"Motive, means, and, of course, with Porter out wandering around the backwoods with his friend from Minnesota, plenty of opportunity," Lucas said. "I'll need this guy's name."
"I'll get your whole file on him tomorrow," Carter said.
Lucas said, "Don't get killed before then."
"I'll try not to. But it's Porter they want, not a humble farm girl from Tifton, Georgia."
Neither of them wanted a second drink, and Lucas walked Carter back to her apartment building. She lit up a thin, dark cigarillo with a stainless steel Zippo, leaving a scent trail of cigar smoke and lighter fluid behind them. As they walked, she said,
About that whole motive-means thing, what worries me is the motive is there, but does it seem strong enough? To me, it doesn't. She's been quite good at fending off Porter. She's had people talking about Porter being a little unbalanced, maybe senile. That has an effect, too, enough that I told Porter he ought to back off. He hasn't yet, but he will. I mean, he's back in the Senate, so what's the point? Hate? The thing about senators is they learn when to cut their losses, she said. Porter knows that better than most. He'll figure out that a knife in the back is better than hitting her with a ball-peen hammer. I mean, maybe she's twisted enough to murder him or have somebody else do it, but I'm not happy about the motive. I'll grant you the means, but the motive seems weak. I'll make a note, Lucas said. Need more motive. Do that. At the door to her building, she said, I hope you're as smart and mean as you obviously think you are. This is a different league here. Lucas smiled his Wolverine smile and said, Another thing we'll have to disagree about. I know people from Washington think that, but from the outside, D.C. looks like a pile of shysters and hucksters and general-purpose hustlers. If you were warning me about New York or L.A., I'd say okay. But Washington? Washington I can handle. I hope you don't learn otherwise, Carter said, and went through the door. Lucas walked back to the hotel, quietly whistling the opening riffs of J.J. Cale's Fancy Dancer. Washington, D.C. He was going to kick ass and take names. He woke up the next morning feeling less confident, having slept on what Carter had said. If Smalls and Whitehead had been attacked by professionals, and it certainly seemed that way, then there was a real danger. The killers were unlikely to go after a marshal because that would attract too much notice. They could go after Smalls, though, and if they gave up on subtlety... It wasn't that hard to shoot somebody in the back, he thought, as he shaved. Gangbangers did it all the time and walked away. Former SEALs, Delta, Rangers, all were thoroughly trained and inured to killing. America had somehow gotten itself in the position of creating thousands of efficient professional killers and, at the same time, had provided them with easy access to the weapons needed for the job. You could get a perfectly adequate Savage 30-06 at your local Walmart for less than $400. His neighbor at the lake cabin had done that, and the rifle could make a minute of angle shot all day and all night. He'd gotten out of the shower and was trying to decide between a pair of bright red jockey shorts and a more subdued pair with horizontal green stripes when his phone rang. He picked it up, looked at the screen, clicked on, and said, Hey, Ray. Lucas, what are you doing? I'm on a highly secret mission in Washington, Lucas said. If you were here, I'd tell you all about it. How's Bob? Ray Givens laughed. You know what the stump is doing? Wind sprints. Honest to God, it's like watching a tractor trailer trying to drag race. But he's good. Good to go. Ray and Bob Matisse were marshals assigned to the Special Operations Group located in Louisiana. They'd been with Lucas as they chased a hardcore holdup man and multiple murderer across the face of Texas. Lucas had killed him in the town of Marfa, but not before Bob had been shot through both legs by an accomplice. Lucas asked, Good to go, but where's he going? Well, I called up the Minneapolis office to see what you were up to, and they told me you were in Washington, but they couldn't say why. I thought I'd call you up and see if we could help. Lucas walked over to his window and pulled back the curtains as he said, Tell you what, Ray. Right now, I'm looking at files, not even quite doing that yet. I'll be looking at them later today. This could get tense, and it could get political, and it might not do your careers a lot of good to get involved.
Come on, man, this is Ray you're talking to.
Okay, Ray, let me ask you this. What if our targets turn out to be CIA or military guys?
Uh-oh.
Yeah. There was a moment of silence, then she said, You know what? I'd still be up for it. Bob would be, too.
Right now, I'm trying to find this dude who walked out of a federal lockup in an ID mix-up.
But he's about as dangerous as a head of lettuce. I'll get him, maybe, but I've got to pretend like I care. Come on, tell me what you're doing. Give me some specifics.
This is going to sound a little paranoid, but I'm not going to tell you on the phone, Lucas said. He was looking out at the Potomac, a nice view to the west, a forest on the far bank. If you didn't already know it, you'd never guess that a major city was at your back. Let me look at these files, talk to a few people. If I need help, you're the one I'll call.
All right. Well, shit. Back to tracking Warren Beasley, who, if he has any brains at all, ditched a couple million bucks where we can't find it, and has already crossed the border and is now drinking pink cocktails with umbrellas in them.
That kind of guy.
Yeah, pharmaceuticals, Ray said. Sold about a ton more hydrocodone to doctors than the doctors actually got. Skimmed maybe 8 mil. Got 5 years at Club Fed. Skipped on a pre-sentencing bond.
Good luck.
Call me, damn it.
He had ordered breakfast and was drinking the first Diet Coke of the day when Carter called.
I've got several files for you. Are you carrying a laptop?
Yes.
I've had everything reduced to PDFs, so you should be good. I'll come to you if you're still at the hotel.
I am, eating breakfast, same table.
15 minutes.
Lucas was working his way through a Washington Post when Carter arrived. She was wearing an upscale tan business dress and heels, oversized Prada sunglasses, and carried a burgundy leather satchel over her shoulder. She waved at a waiter, ordered coffee, sat across from Lucas, dug into her bag, and slid a thumb drive across the table to him.
"The man you want is named Jack Parrish. I got a serious file on him, but I had to hint to the guy who gave it to me that we might have a romantic future together, which we don't. Read it fast so you can tell me if I have to go back to the guy before I turn him down."
"Not even gonna give him a shot?" Lucas asked. "You ever hear about working a source?"
"You haven't met the guy," Carter said.
"Does Brill Cream addiction suggest anything good to you?"
"Ouch.
On the other hand, we may need as much help as we can get."
"Where'd the guy get the files?"
"Background checks for the Intelligence Committee," Carter said.
"The committee has its own set of files on its personnel. I wouldn't have access to these myself except for my Brill Cream buddy who works in the file room, so speed read and get back to me."
Lucas told her that his self-confidence had waned over the evening, but that he was more worried about Smalls than about himself.
"While she might hate me, she can figure the odds.
Killing me might feel good, but eventually it'd come back to bite her in the ass."
"When do you think you'll know something? Anything?"
"I don't know. I'll call when I do. In another case a year ago, I had some strange experiences with cell phones." He reached in his pocket, took out a burner phone, and handed it to her. "I bought a couple of burners before I left St. Paul. I'll call you from mine before you leave here, so you'll have my number. Only use the burner to call my burner. Never call my burner from your regular phone, and don't call any other number from your burner. This is strictly for you and me."
"You think they're monitoring us?"
"I don't think anything in particular. Like I said, my last case had some weird turns because of cell phones. I don't trust them as far as I could spit a rat," Lucas said.
When Carter had gone, with Lucas's secret cell number in her new burner phone, Lucas went back up to his room. There, he traded his jacket and slacks for a